The state governments have the obligation to raise their own taxes. They get some of them from the federal government, but most of it they've got to raise themselves. One of the ways they raise their revenue is by...
Today we have another amazing property-based episode. Rod is a property lawyer and has been a property lawyer here on the Gold Coast for the last 43 years.
The best way to think about trustee and the trust is like the hat on your head and your body. The hat on your head is the trustee. It can come off and I can put a new trustee on. The trust itself is the you. That still owns the asset.
What is land tax? How does it work? Yep. What are the thresholds?
The government grabs the money from you and says thank you. It goes into the consolidated revenue for the state and they spend it wherever they like.
Why are we paying stamp duty interest and how does that all work out?
How important is it to use a lawyer, predominantly in property?
Secret.
Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of the Unemployable Podcast. Today we have another amazing property-based episode. We've got Rod here who's joined us in the studio. Rod is a property lawyer and has been a property lawyer here on the Gold Coast for the last 43 years. Not only is a property lawyer, this is the man that Shannon and Carson have been using for the last 7-8 years on their own personal developments. And we thought we'd bring him in here and get the lowdown on everything property law. So I just want to say thank you very much, Rod, for making your way down here today.
Thanks, Eric.
This is Rod's first podcast, so we're very excited to have him on board. And we'll take it easy on you today, so don't worry.
No problem.
And we've got Carson and we've got Shannon here again. Mate. How are you?
Good.
Good, mate. I'm excited.
It's going to be a good one. For those of you guys that don't know who Carson and Shannon are, we keep repeating ourselves, but we know that everybody doesn't watch every single podcast. Shannon and Carson are probably the most two humble guys that I've met in a very, very long time for the amount of success that they've had in a fairly short period of time. 4 years ago, Carson was literally cleaning carpets and Shannon was a machine operator. And 4 years later, they've accumulated $100 million of land deals in the pipeline and over 170 lots of land. And these guys are absolutely killing it. And I just want to say, guys, thank you so much for being you guys and sharing all the knowledge that you guys have learned over the last 4 years, really, on this journey and the success that you've had. Now, you basically do small to medium scale developments in the property space. So tell us a little bit about, I guess, Rod, your business. It's Johansson Lawyers. They're based here in Bundle on the Gold Coast. And like I said before, 43 years experience.
Yeah, look out, hey.
That's longer than I've been alive, by the way. I don't want to make you feel old.
No.
I think of that,
I get that.
Like that is amazing. And one of the best parts, guys, is when off camera, I'm like, all right, Rod. So at the end, just so we can see, so we could tell people, how can we get a hold of you? I'm like, what's the best website? What's the email? And he's like, I don't have a website. Never had a website. I'm a bit old school, he says. So tell us a little bit old school. Tell us a little bit about Rod and Johansson Lawyers.
Okay, cool. Genesis out of being with a law firm, Short Punch and Greatricks, who are iconic on the Gold Coast. I was there doing what's called articles, like your apprenticeship, articles of clerkship while you were studying law. And that gives you the benefit of A, studying, as well as B, working practically at the same time. And so in the process of that, you're actually developing skill sets, meeting people even while you're still young, and gauging what works, what doesn't work in terms of how you deliver the product to people and make it understandable. Go through the law degree, become a solicitor working for them. Around that time, a couple of the partners were wanting to leave the law firm, and the other partners were saying, okay, well, how best do we fund all of this? And so they made an offer to three lawyers, myself being one of them, to come on in, share some money with them, and that would help them pay out the outgoing partners. Two of the guys didn't take up the offer. They said thanks very much, but good opportunity, we'll nick off as well. I ended up being the only person that picked up the ball and on that one. A couple of years later, same offer made for some more people, in they came. We were running about 10 partners at the time, 80 odd staff. And then through all that period, we did the fun things like with the 1980s and the recessions and so forth. I became a partner just in time for us having to downsize. We'd just finished a third level on the building. It was initially a two-level building on Bundle Road. It's now three levels. At the time, we just finished that third level, had all the rent to pay for it and nowhere to fill it. There was not much work going on. And as a partnership, when you decided, okay, well, we've got to trim some staff, who's going to tell them the bad news? The new boy. Well, let's get the new boy. And so... So funnily enough, I was known for wearing, then I had to wear ties, but I would always wear comic ties, funny ties of some description or another. This particular day, I just came in with a black tie, unbeknownst to me, this is what was going to be happening. And so, of course, it was black tie day from that day forward. People would come through the door and say, you know, bring them up, say, could you come in, see me for a minute? Like, should I bring my book in for some dictation? No, you won't be needing that. It's okay. And then I'd have to tell them the good news and they'd leave, and then another one. So yeah, that was the baptism of fire. So got through there, was partner there for 10 years, had married kids, and late 90s, I suspect it was, divorce from my first wife, that led to the divorcing from the partnership and saying, okay, well, look, you know, the things that I like to do, you guys aren't doing, and vice versa. So how about we just separate and I'll go elsewhere, which I did. Went off to Atwood Marshall at Coolangatta at that stage. They had a couple of offices then, but I was at the Coolangatta end. There was a restraint of trade that I had to live out based on going into the partnership. So I figured, well, 25 metres from the New South Wales Queensland border was close enough to saying I wasn't on the Gold Coast. Partnership at Short Punch were happy enough to say, yeah, that's fine, stay there, and you know, don't muddle with us, we won't muddle with you. So that was okay. Did a couple of years with Edward Marshall, learned a lot about New South Wales conveyancing as well, because they were on the border and most of their business was that way. A couple of years later, they were then starting to have growing pains, and they then fragmented into Atwood Marshall as it is now, and Small Myers Hughes became genesis out of that. Just before that happened, I took my leave from them late 2003 and went on my own. So I've actually been working for myself since 2003. Along the way, clients I picked up through the years at Short Punch come back repeat clients to myself. Had some people in yesterday that reminded me that they've been using me for 25 years already, and that was the first time they were saying, as they were doing their wills, are you going to, how long do you plan to be around doing this? And I give them my usual answers that I've only just passed my halfway mark in my estimation, you know, so I'm planning on being around for, you know, 120, 130, something like that years. But in terms of working, realistically, my current wife is saying, well, probably in the next 10 years, you've got to look to winding yourself down a bit from the frenetic pace that I currently perform. The boys will tell you, or if they haven't already, that I do a shift of the morning where I get up in the morning about 4 o'clock, head into the office, and I work from 4 until 7, go home, get the family up, get them all organised, have breakfast, et cetera, shower, shave, all that. Well, when I had no shave. Head back to the office around 9:30, stay there till 6:30, something like that, 7 o'clock at night, depending on what's going on at the time. And then still taking calls. Got clients that are diverse in their location, some in South Africa, some in America, some in Great Britain, in the UK. That then ties in with, okay, well, it's 9 o'clock at night here. That'll be a good time to get them over there. And so you'll ring them and you're still working, notwithstanding you're at home, just to keep the ball rolling for them. So their transaction keeps going as well.
And what's the majority of the work that you do when you look at you know, your law firm in regards to a percentage of property versus wills versus, you know, everything else?
Okay. Probably, I would say it's at least 90% property.
Yeah.
And when we say property, conveyancing for purchases and sales, mainly investment driven of those, still act for the mums and dads for their purchases, but there's enough other conveyancers and lawyers out there that do the mum and dad stuff that people sometimes look and say, oh, Rod, I think you're a bit dear about what you do. And I say, well, my job is to deliver a good service to you, and I can do that at that price point. If I go under that, I may as well stay on the beach, you know, because I can go broke in style as opposed to going broke working my wrist off for you. So that's sort of the mentality to it. And so buying and selling, developers, acquisitions, develop, sell for land, townhouses, usually three-story walk-ups, things like that. Those sorts of things are the forte. It's not to say that I couldn't do the larger buildings, but they tend to be cherry-picked off by the other larger law firms in any event.
How important is it we have a range of viewers that listen to the podcast, people that are, you know, interested in property and seasoned veterans, and we have newbies, right? People that are just learning, you know, the basics of property development. So how important is it to use a lawyer, because everyone has a friend who knows a friend that knows a lawyer, right? And then there's lawyers and there's lawyers, yeah, right? So how important is it to use when you're into the property development space, doing stuff like what Carson and Shannon are doing and what myself are doing, small scale developments and land subdivisions and whatnot? How important is it to use a lawyer predominantly in property versus just a lawyer that does a little bit of property, but they also do this, and this? What's the big difference?
Segmenting of your time, I suspect, is the right answer for that one. So you sit there and say, okay, well, if my job was 20% leasing, 20% mortgaging, 20% on property, 20% on wills, and general other for the last 20, then I'm diversified over, and you're looking for someone who has a concentrated amount of knowledge on a particular topic for property development, as opposed to that generic knowledge. The generic knowledge will get you through every day, conveyancing, buying and selling. In amongst all of what we were saying before, which I didn't touch on and I probably should have, which will lead into that, answering this question, was whilst I was at Atwood Marshall, they were very big on having as many of their lawyers as possible accredited specialists in their area, and they were happy to engage and make the time available for me to go and become an accredited specialist in property law. I was the second year that they ran the course through the Law Society. The first year there was some 40 odd people that went through, and I don't know, about 20 odd plus passed that exam, and they became accredited. The year that I went through, there's another 45 odd people at the exam the day we took it. And I found out later, you do all this stuff more or less in isolation, other than for the one exam. And then sometime later you get told that here's how you went on your assignments and here's how you went at the exam. And oh, by the way, you've ticked the box, Rod, you can become an accredited specialist. You say, oh, fantastic. How many else? Just you and one other out of 45. And you sit there and think, wow, and was this year that hard, you know? And it's not that it wasn't that hard. There was a lot of people in my year that went through that were from the regional areas of Queensland, and a lot of the questions that were in the specialist accreditation thing were related to leasing and property transactions and body corporate stuff like that, all of the stuff I was doing every day of the week. So for me, it was not quite a walk in the park. I ended up with bumps on my fingers from writing on and so forth, because again, when you're doing your exam, you don't sit there with a laptop and type out the answers, you handwrite them. Anyway, a lot of those guys, If the questions had been more about how do we adjust cattle and what do we need to worry about, what about the fracking, how's that going to impact on the property acquisition, what about the LNG lines that are going through, the natural gas lines that are going through your property, I would have been at sixes and sevens. I would have been like the other guys, and I probably wouldn't have passed because that wasn't something I did every day down on the Gold Coast where the majority of the work was. You don't see a hell of a lot of that. You know, it's a fairly new, relatively speaking, relatively new area. And in Southeast Queensland, most times the everything's now covered by easements. It's been done since 1980s. All of the local authorities have been willing to do all that. Go further afield, you go out in the western areas of Queensland, that stuff's been there since it was New South Wales and before that. And sometimes you look at the property titles and it's at the top of it. It used to be part of New South Wales. So it's you get a broader spectrum of things out there. But yeah, so the importance of it is, yes, accredited specialists are great. You get them. You get their years of knowledge and wisdom that bring it all to the fore. You can quickly evaluate, if you've got the knowledge, you quickly evaluate what are the key points that are going to be relevant and what are going to be problematic, so that you can then say to the client, okay, well, look, there's all of this stuff that I don't even have to worry about searching because of these reasons, and I know that's all going to be okay. But this stuff over here, this is what we've got to worry about, and you've got to focus your time on, and you can then give direction to them to, you know, look and search and whatever.
So with conveyances versus lawyers, we see it all the time with people that are buying our blocks. Yep. And I always say to people, look, go find a conveyancer or a lawyer. Mm. And I've seen it firsthand the last 7-8 years. How many times they screw it up, the conveyances.
Yep.
And so I always say to people, my advice is spend the extra few $100.
Yep.
Get a lawyer that understands, especially if you're buying off the plan. There's a lot of stuff that, you know, the conveyancers are just not picking up. And we might get a couple of requests to remove, you know, this, you know, or the land tax or whatever it might be. And then 90% of the conveyancers just gloss over it. And we had one recently where the conveyancer actually lost their client $100,000 on the project up in Mawson we did, because they exercised the due diligence clause too early, and that we were still negotiating the price, and then they locked themselves in a price where we were actually going to reduce the price, and cost them $100,000, because they didn't have a solicitor looking over it. So what would your advice be to people even just buying a house or off the plan? Is there, what's the difference between the two, and then what would your advice be around it?
Okay, so the conveyances, there are quite a lot of good conveyances out there, in spite of what you sort of say, oh, there's these horror stories out there. There's horror stories in every element of whatever goes on in life. There are a lot of good conveyancers out there that do a good job and give me a good run for my money. Some of them, there's a saying that they've forgotten more than I've ever known, you know, so they're that good. But there are others that, yes, you're paying for what you get, you know, pay for monkeys, pay peanuts, get monkeys sort of thing. Mm. And that's not a slight on monkey conveyancing down here. They're good operators.
Yeah.
So for everyday mum and dad's conveyancing stuff, run-of-the-mill stuff, they're geared for that, and they're geared for volume, and you can get a good bang for your buck. I was living in a street near TSS here, which is an expensive area in Southport. I was renting there for a while. The guy across the road from me had just sold his house on Paradise Point for $9 million. And he was renting a house opposite me, and before he went into his next venture. And we were chatting. He would let me borrow his ride-on mower to cut the grass on the front of my property, because he hated to see me push my mower around, which I love doing. It's the only time I get to not listen and think about anything else, put music on, just mow. That's it. It's my zen spot. But anyway, he would come and give me those. And yet, he would go to the conveyancers because they would only charge him $400 or $500 to do the conveyance of his $2 million factory that just sold and things like this. And I'm sitting there scratching my head, going, "You're insane, you know. At least get some." He said, "But they're only going to charge me $2,000, and they're doing the same thing. I'm saving myself all this money." I said, "Okay." So that's why he was driving around in old Ferraris. So they look like Magnum made a Magnum PI, you know. And again, that's dating me, and you guys are sitting there saying, "What's a Magnum PI?" It was an old TV show. The guy drove around in a big mustache and like Shannon's got here, and used to drive around the Ferrari. Anyway, he's a good fella. But so when you're looking for something more nuanced and you're wanting to plan to do a development, which is coming back to your question, is yes, then it pays to spend a little bit more dough, go to a lawyer that's got some knowledge in that area. You're getting benefit out of them. Some of the law firms, they charge on a hourly basis and a time record and all that sort of stuff. That becomes an expensive way to do it. Myself, I loathe all those contraptions ever since the Americans decided that was a fantastic idea. And then they exported the idea to Australia and all the people over here said, oh, wow, let's time record. This is going to be great and good for making money for us. Not so good for the people that are actually paying. But that's not their problem. Our problem is padding our pockets. So the first couple of days I had the time recording machine on my desk when I was at Short Punch Graderics was I was doing 24 hours of time recording in 1 8-hour session because when things were on the trot, something's going wrong, you're picking up the phone ring saying, Eric, are you okay with this? Shannon, are you okay with that? Carson, are you okay with this? And each one of those is a 6-minute unit, 6666666. All of a sudden, I've wasted 2 minutes on that little phone conversation that we all just had, and already I've built up half an hour, you know. So you sit there and think, wow, this is insane. And as quick as I could, I got away from it.
So what is a conveyancer? For those that don't know, right, what is a conveyancer and what do they do? What when we use that term loosely, conveyancing.
Yep. Yeah.
Right? But for those that don't know, what is a conveyancer and what is conveyancing?
Okay, so a conveyance, if you want to take it back to its basics, a conveyance is the actual passing of something from me to you. If I pick up the eight ball, I can convey that to you, or I give it to you. It could also be through verbal. You know, I convey the word, convey the message of what it is for me to you. So that's conveying things.
Yep.
The conveyancer is someone who participates in doing that process. It's over time, property conveyancing it started off with you were doing property. You were initially, prior to the 80s, there weren't conveyancers in Queensland. They just were outlawed. They were in New South Wales, but they weren't up here. And so, slowly but surely they wore the Queensland government down, and allowed conveyancers to come in. But at the top of that conveyancing company, there's got to be a qualified lawyer that is overseeing that operation, so that in theory the people down here, if they get into trouble, they can go and ask their lawyer to say, hey, what do I do now? And they've still got the benefit of that lawyer at the top of the tree. And so what they do is invariably, if you've gone out, bought a property and signed for it on the dotted line or bid at an auction and won at the auction, yeah, and you haven't even seen anyone yet, and someone sits there and says, oh, okay, you've just bought a property. Are you going to get someone to look after that transaction for you? Much like you've just bought a brand new car, are you going to have someone to look after your servicing for you? Yeah, sure, but it's brand new. Do I need a service yet? No, that's down here, but let's stitch you up for that now, and away we go. Well, for the property side of things is, yes, you should have one of these people that look after these things for you, because not easy. It's full of jargon, and people can get lost on that. And so, the idea is you're handing it over to someone else to manage that process for you. Hopefully, they will take all the technical and difficult legal concepts and explain them to you in a way that you can understand. And then you go, okay. Plenty of statistics out there that apart from divorce, buying and selling a property is the most stressful thing that you'll do in your life, especially if you sell your house today and you're buying the house you're going to move into today as well. If both are settling at the same time, that's taking your stress levels up next level. If you sell your house today, but you've already settled on the one you're buying and you've got a 7-day window in between, or you've got somewhere to go on holiday while you wait for the other one to settle, no problem. That's done. Then the next one starts. And even if it's only 7 days later, the levels of stress that you suffer are greatly reduced.
And conveyancing and property law, right? Like, obviously they fall under the same umbrella, but what you do for Carson and Shannon is a lot different than what you would do just for a mom and pop that's going to buy their family,
correct,
brick and tile home that they're going to come with to you. And after they bought, you know, put an offer at Ray White, and they said, yeah, okay, I accept, and then go, okay, who's your conveyancer?
Yep.
All right, Rod Johansson is our conveyancer, and then you're going to go and you're going to do searches and do these types of things. So what's the big difference between a conveyancer
yep.
and what you do for the likes of clients like Carson and Shannon?
Okay. Two things. Conveyances, some of the conveyancing companies out there, this will be a roundabout answer again, sorry. They put a cap on what they do. They sit there and say, oh, okay, if you've got an off-the-plan contract, sorry, we don't do those. You'll have to go and see someone else. That's okay. That's their choice. They can sit there and say, I don't want to do that sort of work. Mm-hmm. It's like if you came to me today and said, listen, Rod, I want you to defend me for a driving under the influence charge. I'd sit there and say, I'm sorry, that's not my expertise. I'll refer you over to someone that knows what they're doing, and you go see them, they'll take care of you. And if I stick to my knitting and other people do that, then theoretically we won't get into too much trouble. The mum and dad stuff, yes, we search to make sure that the title to the property is unencumbered. If it's encumbered, it will be unencumbered by settlement. Is there any easements on it? Any things that certainly in the older parts of the Gold Coast, back prior to the 1960s, it was common for councils and developers to lay pipes anywhere and everywhere to service for sewer and water. And there was a thing in the Local Government Act that used to be the act back in that day that said, if that pipe goes in the ground and it's a council benefited pipe, then it has an implied easement. Fantastic. Okay, so means that the council can come across your land and dig it up and do whatever, because it's implied. So when I go and look at my title search, I say, where does it say here there's an easement? There's none.
I'm going through that right now at the moment, which they're calling it a unregistered easement, right?
Correct.
And literally it shows a pipe servicing water to a neighboring property.
Correct.
And then I rang a mate of mine that's one of the certified plumbers for the Gold Coast City Council, because they got a list. You can't just get any plumber. And we went out there and met him on site, and he had a look, and he was looking at the pipes and the water meters and where it is. He goes, 95% chance this pipe's actually not even here any longer. So it's quite interesting. Yeah, because these are a lot of the things that people don't realize, right? Like the difference between a good conveyancer and an average conveyancer can cost you thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars, depending on what kind of land or development or investment that you're buying. Now, you said a couple things there, like, you know, checking things, whether there's an encumbrance on it or not, an easement or not. What's an encumbrance?
Okay, an encumbrance is something that, like its name says, it encumbers a property. It affects your ability to use it to the fullness of what you would expect. We're looking for, if there is a mortgage on there, we would call that an encumbrance, and we would want to make sure that the seller has enough money out of the settlement to discharge that, so that when we have the title transferring from you to me, that there's no mortgage anymore. My bank can come in or I'll come in if I'm cash, or the bank will come in and they'll take my property as security.
Yeah.
The other encumbrances are things that you're just mentioning about the infrastructure pipes that might be under the ground. And there are certainly in the hills around the Gold Coast, and this is applicable to other parts of Queensland and New South Wales. The New South Wales has a slightly different system, but the council will put a covenant on the land, and they'll sit there and say, okay, the land is level down here, but rises steeply at the back, and that's heavily treed. And oh, by the way, it might have koalas that run through there as a native path. Could have other wildlife that travel that way all the time, kangaroos, etc. And so they'll sit there and say, righto, you'll own 10 acres of land, or sorry, 1 hectare of land, but the back 4.4 of a hectare, we have a covenant over that you can't build on, can't use, you can't plant trees up there, you can't let your dog or cat run in that area, because you've got a domesticated animal going into a wild environment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things will happen to either them, they'll get diseases, or us, your animals, they'll eat them. So they're trying to, you know, maintain the balance and keep nature going.
And there's also things like caveats as an example, caveat, right? Yep. So can you explain a caveat or some people call it a lien?
Okay, so that's a different thing again. So a caveat is the word caveat is warning, and it's that when you put it on a title, it's meant to be able to give a warning to the world at large that there is something, there's a claim coming about this property and we don't know what it is, or we will know. The caveat's meant to give you a brief outline of on what basis I am caveating the title. In family law arena, you and I are married, and we happened to decide that you had the house in your name, and I was your new toy boy, and happy days. But after 10 years of being your toy boy, I get the shits literally, and I want to go elsewhere,
lucky you.
Yeah. I then say, well, hang on, I've been with you for 10 years and we created all this wealth together, but what do I get? And so I go and see a family lawyer. The first thing they will do is put a caveat on your title to say, I've got an equitable interest in it as a homemaker and parent, or as a spouse, or for my contributions in kind, not in money. And so that will give me a basis then to go off to the family court, get an order that I get a chunk of your asset. So that is one way the caveat can be used. Another way would be, Carson's agreed to sell me the property for $600,000. I then hear in the background that he sold the same property to Shannon for $650,000. He hasn't told me that yet, but he's going to think of a way that he's going to sell that to me to say, I'm sorry, Rod, when I took the property back to the vendor, they wouldn't sign your offer. It's gone to someone else. I'm sorry. And I'll sit there and go, no, that's not right. And so I'll put a caveat on the title to say, I've got an equitable interest in it, and I'll try and stop Shannon from doing what he has to do. I had that exact scenario happen in a slightly west of Brisbane the other week, farming area. One neighbour said, "Yes, I'll sell to you." They sat at the table. They agreed on all terms. Can I stay there a bit longer? Yes, sure. And that all was nice. And my guys had to go off and feed some potty calves and so forth. And they said, "Well, we'll go." The agent said, "Yeah, go do your business, and we'll sign up, and we'll get this thing back to you tomorrow." Week goes by. We still don't see the contract back. Next thing we know, they've dealt with someone else, and they're telling us, "Hey, no, you didn't get the deal. We've sold it to someone else." And so the battle starts. I get a caveat ready to lodge. At the same time as we're trying to protect that interest, I'm also talking to the client about the practicality of it. Now, if we do this, this is what will happen. If do you want that to happen? Given this is your neighbour, is that the right thing to be doing? How do you want to best handle things? Talk more about the practical aspects. And then we decided to hold the caveat, and it was sitting in what's called PEXA, which we'll get to in a minute. It's sitting there at the lodge, waiting for me to press the button. And they eventually said, don't press the button, just forget it. We'll just let the dust settle and go on about business.
It's a very strong instrument when you're the one implying it.
Yeah.
But when you're the one receiving it on the other end, it's a pain in the ass, because basically you can't take it off. Right,
like it can, yeah. It's
like is it the and the reason why I'm saying this, guys, is these little things are very important. This could be the difference between paying $500 to this conveyancer over here who got referred to you by a mate, versus someone that's $1,000 or $2,000 that is a little bit more thorough in their checks.
Yeah.
Now with caveats as an example,
yeah,
the person that put the caveat on, are they the only ones that can then remove it?
Okay, so yeah, the brief history on the caveats for that, or synopsis on the caveats. The conveyancers are generally they at that limit. They'll sit there and say, "Sorry, you know, this is a caveat there. That's not something we do. Or if we do it, we'll have to charge you a lot more. Otherwise, go over and see a specialist lawyer for that." So the objective then is, if you've got to come to me and said, "Yes, I've got a caveat on my title," first thing I do is have a read of the caveat, see what the grounds are, ask you and investigate what this is, the backstory behind that, to establish whether there's anything in writing that might give the person who put the caveat on a better right than you think they should have. It could be for money, which is when you, before you said about a lien, I'll diversify just one sec. When you talked about it as being a lien, that would be, I've lent you money and you said to me, yeah, look, you can take a charge over my property, then I'll use a caveat for that. But on those caveats, there's in the property legislation in Queensland, those caveats can only last for 90 days. And at the end of the 90 days, they lapse, win, lose or draw, without doing anything else. And so if, for example, I lent you that money and I lent it for a year and I put the caveat on your title at the beginning of the loan, if you're smart, you'll know that 3 months after that has gone on, it can be lapsed. You can go to the titles office and say, 3 months is up, get rid of it. It'll go off. I don't get notified it's been taken off. It just goes off. And you then go out and borrow another $100,000 from someone else and put another caveat on. And you could do that 2-3 times. And, you know, and all of these people think that they've got an equity in your property, but they don't.
So do you need a registered caveat then?
That's a registered caveat. Yeah. So you take your caveat and you register, which is basically what the Eric scenario was. Hey, I've just got notice from the titles office that a caveat's on there. Mm. Interestingly, the electronic titling system now, and it used to be, again, grey cells and age, you would physically take the document in, you'd lodge it. It might take the titles office a couple of days to register it. In the meantime, the first thing they do was they'd send a registered letter to the KBT, as it's called, the person who's going to receive it, to say, this is what's happening. And you might get knowledge of the caveat even before it's registered, especially if there's some flaw in it. And the titles office examine it and say, I don't actually think that's a caveat of interest. Rod, please explain. And unless I give a proper explanation, they can say, no, we're not allowing that to register, in which case the whole thing just dies a natural death for you. So for me as a lawyer, I look for all those things around it. Is there something that will allow it to stick, or it would allow me to say to the titles office, that shouldn't stick for these reasons? Mm-hmm. You can always negotiate to get the caveat off. If you reach agreement with the other side, fantastic. For whatever reason that you come to, then they withdraw the caveat, or you get a withrawal of the caveat. The other is, if it's on there, I've seen this happen before, where Bill Smith, who lives at 27 East Lake River Road, West Werevanil, puts a caveat on. You sit there and think, what? What's this? Bill Smith. Do you know Bill Smith? I don't know Bill Smith. What's this address? You go and Google it, or you go onto your mapping programs and you try and find that address, and you find that it's the left bank of the Brisbane River and there's no one there. It's a vacant block of land. Well, no one's living there. So there's a fair chance this thing's all a sham. Mm. So I can go to the titles office and say that, and they go, it looks okay on its face. We've registered it. So then I've got to go and make an application to a court to say, this caveat's gone on my title. Bill Smith, whilst there may be dozens of Bill Smiths out there, this particular Bill Smith who signed this piece of paper and lodged it doesn't exist. That address doesn't exist. Here's all the things I've had to do. Please allow me to have the caveat removed. Okay, and I can get it off. Sounds fantastic. That comes with a price tag. And when you walk into the lawyer, they go, oh, get that caveat off. Yes, I can. How much is that going to cost me? Well, it's kind of, you know, $15,000 to $20,000. So there you go. Someone's lodged a caveat they shouldn't have. You've copped a $20,000 bill to get it off just so that you can go on and settle your property.
Yeah.
If the person that put the caveat on did it maliciously and has actually, what I would call stupidly, used their own name and put it all on properly, then that person has to come into court and explain why the caveat went on, and the court can make an order. They not only pay the cost of the court action, but they can charge them with additional damages, punitive damages for putting it on. And you can sit there and say, I was about to settle this $20 million property today, and I wasn't able to do it because of your caveat. I'm now having to hold it for another 3 weeks, which is costing me $10,000 a week. I've got $30,000 loss plus this $20,000 in court fees. The court will say to the KBT, okay, I'm ordering you to pay that guy $50,000. Again, sounds great. But in a generic sense, you sit there and go, okay, great, I've now got this fantastic judgment, $50,000 against Eric. Great. Rod, can you go and get some money for me? And I go, okay, well, let's quickly do a search to see if Eric owns anything. No, Eric owns nothing. But he lives in that nice house, but he might be renting it. it's owned by a company. Let's see who's behind the company that owns it. No Eric's here. It's a trust. Oh, who's behind that trust? If you can get a copy from the title's office, maybe you'll see who's behind it. If you can't get a copy, you've got to then, you know, try and find some other method to get to find out who owns the property to work out whatever. Mm-hmm. So just getting the judgment itself isn't the win.
And this is why it's so important. Like I've always been, when it comes to lawyers and conveyancers, I'm the type of person that I rather pay a little bit more and know someone has the experience and has been down that road and seen this. I want to ask one question, and I'd love to dig into business structures.
Yep.
I don't know if you do. You have any other questions at the moment, Carson?
Lots of questions.
Your any burning desires? I just want to ask.
He's looking at this as being free legal advice at the moment.
Well, dude,
it's not invited. Yeah.
I want to ask one question, and then we'll let Carson release some of that ammo over there, and then. But I really want to touch at some point on business and legal structures, because there's a lot of people that will be listening to this, and we use JVs, which are joint ventures and partnerships. And then you got sole traders and you got companies and you got trusts. And without diving too deep, just a very, very top level on what they are and when you would use those. Okay. But before that, I'll ask one question, then we'll get some off Carson's plate. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you see property developers, right? Especially non-seasoned property developers making when they're going into contracts on land. What are some of the big things? What are the big mistakes that you?
Okay, hopefully if I'm seeing them, they're not making them. But because I'm catching them at that time and saying
that's you though. Yeah, yeah. Doesn't mean that everyone's Rod Johansson.
And a lot of these guys know best. Okay, you can't tell me anything. I know. I'm just going out to do this. And they walk in with the document already signed. And for a lawyer, we in one hand, we breathe a sigh of relief to sit there and go, oh, thank God he signed it all before it came in here, because now I can't be pinged for the fact that he didn't get proper advice around what's in there. He did it all on himself. And now all I've got to do is the egg's broken. Now all I've got to do is clean up the mess and do it in the best possible way. There's no way I'm going to get Humpty Dumpty back together again, because it's just not possible. So the biggest things are if you don't know much about the property to put in due diligence provisions, give yourself a window of opportunity to investigate the asset, take it off the market, or effectively put it off the market for the moment whilst you do due diligence on it to make sure it's everything you're expecting it to be. A lot of people will sit there and go, I'm going to build this thing here. I bought this block of land. I'm going to knock that house down and I'm going to put up a nice type of dwelling that I can rent out Airbnb by the rooms. This will be fantastic. I'll make $20,000 per room per annum, $80,000. I'd never get that if I tried to rent it regularly. This is fantastic. And then you go, okay, you do realize that you're building this in the residential zone of the local authority? Yeah, of course. That's why I'm building it there. But that has with it the implication that it's got to be a dwelling for someone to live in. It's not allowed to be used for equivalent Airbnb. And there's a lot of people, and council, when the Gold Coast City Council, particularly through when we had the games, Commonwealth Games here, it was like Minority Report. If you were here at the time, you drive around the streets here, it was like Minority Report. There's just no traffic on the road. Everyone that lived locally, my brother included, says, oh, I'm not going to hang around for all this. I'm going to Japan. I'll go skiing. So off he went for 2 weeks, no problem. So there was one less car on the road. But that was largely it. There was no one here. Everyone expected this wave of people that are coming in to stay on the Gold Coast and see these games. All of the hotels were sitting there saying, we've got available space. No one was filling them. And all the people with the Airbnbs were picking up all these, you know, people were coming over saying, oh yeah, I'd rather stay there than stay in the hotel. Okay, it cost me 20 grand for 3 weeks. No problem. You know, I'm only here for 3 weeks and, you know, it's me and my team and this is what I want to do. The hotels were complaining to the council saying, hang on, that's not fair. And so the council was then going out and they were trawling the internet to see if Eric was putting his house up online for Airbnb. And if so, you would get a show cause notice.
Yep.
And they were going out like they were confetti.
Explain what that is, because okay. We've received them in the past. We used to have a luxury holiday accommodation business.
Yep.
And every so often we'd get one because you get, you know, someone doing something in an area where they think they can holiday let and they yep. can't. Okay. So explain what that is.
Okay. So the local authority sends you a notice. They can't just come in and shut you down. What they do is they say, we have formed the view that what you are doing is incorrect and in breach of our legislation. And so in procedural fairness, I will give you a notice to show cause why I'm wrong and you're right. And if you come back and show me that here's all the reasons why that you're right and I'm wrong, okay, I'll leave you alone.
It's a scary letter. It's not just a nice letter. It's
no,
letter
it comes.
If you do this, these are the fines. This is like anyone that gets that letter shits their pants.
Yes. Yeah.
Guys, I know this is an ad, but trust me, you want to watch this one because it is an absolutely ripping product for anybody who uses a computer. One of the things I hate the most in business is email and responding to YouTube comments on my computer here. This AI app is a game changer. What it does is it enables me to never type another email again. I'm going to show you how it works, but essentially, instead of typing, I have a key on my computer that I just push the key. I start talking. It dictates everything I said and uses AI to correct any words that it hears after I've trained it a few times where there's misspelling, and it just cuts my email response time in half and enables me to give much deeper, better emails to people. Just check this out. As soon as you see it, you'll see how it works. If you want to get it, there's a link beneath this video. It is insane. It's called Whisper AI. It's a game changer. Let me show you. So this is a scene you've all seen before, writing an email. But instead of going and writing and using my keys here to type in, I'm just going to push that little FN button and I'm going to read this straight in here. So watch this. Hi there. Thanks for watching the podcast. Have a great day. Let it go. Boom. There it is. And I hit send. That's it, guys. Click on the link below the video. Get signed up today. It will save you heaps of time. All my entrepreneurial friends are using it. You can thank me later. Let's get back to the pod.
And at the bottom, again, 10, 15 years ago, the fine might have only been, say, $50,000. I've seen them coming out nowadays. They're $2.5 million and $3 million fines on the letter. I'm sitting there going, wow, that isn't even appropriate to the offence, you know. But nonetheless, that's the fine that they wanted to try and get for you. So show cause notice. If you don't answer that properly, they will then send you a breach notice to say you're in breach of the town plan unless you cease and desist that usage by this specific date. Then we're going to go to court and we're going to get an order against you. And that starts a whole other process. Interesting enough, on Ferry Road many, many years ago, had a client come to me and said, I've got the show cause notice. I go, what are you doing? He said, oh, that they say I'm running a brothel from here. I said, are you? He said, no. I said, okay, well, what do you do there? He said, well, we answer phones. Okay. But nothing on site? No. And what happens? Well, we then send someone in a car and they drive off. I said, okay, well, we'll go back to council. And we did. And we said, no, we're not a brothel. We're a telephone answering service, home-based, and that's it, which was effectively what he was doing. He had the girls sitting in here and he just sent them out in cars. And the council were, you know, a bit mystified by that for a while. We kept them at bay for a couple of months. Then they came back and said, no, I'm not so happy about your explanation there, Rod. I don't quite think that's right.
It's like an Uber brothel.
Basically, that's exactly what it is. So eventually I had to say to the guy look, this one will last you, this next thing I do will last you about 3 or 4 months. After that, you better be out of here because next step after that is fines and charges. Yeah. And you just don't want to be there. Just find somewhere else. And that's what they do.
Yeah. That due diligence clause is one that obviously Shannon and Carson are absolute experts in this and getting long due diligence clauses. Because a lot of people get emotional over property, right? They go, no, but I got to buy it. And they're not giving me due diligence. And there's 5 other people looking at it. And, mm-hmm. you know, the agent has told me I can do this and then do that. But that is probably one of the number one worst mm-hmm. things you can actually do is purchase a property like that without DD. Because listen, it's like dating, right? Everyone's got skeletons in the closet.
Yep.
And that's what you're trying to do is find those skeletons in the closet mm-hmm. on... on these properties, because the last thing you wanted to do is go and spend $1 million, $2 million, $500,000, whatever it is, and then all of a sudden can't be stuck with it and you can't do anything with it.
And then you find that you try and sell it for the money you just paid, and everyone else is doing due diligence and going, I'm sorry.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, especially due diligence and finance clauses.
Fine.
Now, I don't want to cut into Carson's free advice time here. So he's got a bit of a scroll.
Yes.
So let's see how far we can get into that.
Okay.
No, it's funny. Well, the due diligence, I mean, that's something I didn't even know was a term when I was as green as they come. And it's such a, just a double down on that. Like, it's such a critical part of when you're cutting your teeth to get those little DD periods, because if you're really stunned, you can use it to raise some funds and get your structures and stuff set up. But maybe not your structure set up, but you can, you know, bringing in the right people and some funds, but also gives you the time to put your foot on the deal, but then go out and be able to pull out for essentially any reason that you like. Because there's some risk about, some people like to use the finance clause as a DD, and, you know, but I know people that have got caught where the vendor said, hey, you can't use the finance, and that's, the finance clause isn't worded correctly. And they're like, well, actually, I'll give you finance at 10% per annum. And now you can buy the property. And if your clause isn't written right and you think you're pulling out, then technically you might have to settle under those conditions. So yeah, the DD is such a critical part of what you do. I wanted to also go over to options and delayed settlements. What is an option? Can you just explain what the different types of options and just the nominee clause and the stamp duty implications or not in that space?
Okay. So back to the scenario you were using, you're looking at the property, you're being told it's got all these bells and whistles to it, and you'll be able to build the Taj Mahal here if you want. And you go, okay, well, that's great, but I don't see that initially. So If in the case of you guys, when you're looking at large land subdivisions, you're looking at broad acres and you're thinking about how much density of product can I get on the property, it becomes extremely relevant there. If it's just that I'm buying one block and I'm putting a duplex on, can I put a duplex on? Can I maybe put three on? Okay, that's a fairly short time of two phone calls and I'll get the answer for that. Whereas if you're sitting there saying, okay, well, will the council, can I go and speak to them and work out what's going on here? Will they allow me to do this development? Is this something that they would be promoting if I wanted to bring the density down lower, et cetera? So you want that long period of due diligence, what you said before. At the time you're trying to put your foot on the block of land, you're also talking to me and I'm saying, okay, what entity do you wish to buy this in? Which is touching on, Eric, what we're going to go do in structuring. And you'll sit there and say, well, at the moment, I'm really not sure. So we would go and ask the seller of the property, would they allow us to take an option over the property? We signed to say we have a period of, for want of a better word, an exclusive dealing period of 30 days in which we are going to do our due diligence. Inside of that time, we can then do all the things we need to do to find out that the property is what we want. We can also set up our structure. And then at the time we exercise our option, we say, okay, it's now XYZ Proprietary Limited is going to be buying this property, not me personally. And the option then drops away. The contract now proceeds and everything is as it should be for you while you're going through it. There is at a higher level or at a lesser, more granular level, you can get people that will come into an existing estate and say, can I take 10 blocks? I'm a builder. I want 10 blocks and I'm going to put house land packages together and I'm going to take them off and I'm going to sell them to someone else. They may come to us and say, would you allow us to do what's called a put and call option? A call option is a regular option. That means I've got the option to call on you to sell me the property. Okay. And at a set date, I have to exercise that call and say, thank you, sign the contract, away we go. The put and call option is saying, all right, as a developer seller, we're saying, I'm happy to play that game with you, Eric, but at the end of the day, you're putting your hand up for 10 blocks of land. We want to know that we can actually force you to buy it in the event that you haven't exercised your call. So we then put we then create a thing called a put and call option. So the call option gives you the first 30 days or 90 days or however long it is to do your business. And for every one of them that you get away through that time, good luck to you. That's one less you have to settle on. But at that point, if you haven't decided, or you've got three out of 10 left, we will put it to you to say, Eric, time's come. You have to now pay for this. We've got everything we needed to do done. You've got seven away. You've got to buy these last three. And so that's the put option. We've put it to you. You must now settle. So that's the put and call. That's how the option thing works. Invariably, it's used to try and delay the incidence of stamp duty. There's legislation that says that if you do that, you're meant to pay stamp duty on the option fee. So in Queensland, if the first $5,000 of a property value is exempt of stamp duty.
$5,000. That's generous.
It is, isn't it?
Wow.
So if you have an option fee of a dollar, then you don't have to pay stamp duty. The document is still a stampable document, but there's no duty payable. And so you will still satisfy the law by saying, okay, I had a $1 option fee. I paid my stamp duty on. I've exercised my option. I now pay stamp duty on the contract. And the duties office, if they come through looking at all the paperwork, will see a clean slate of things. There's also in the tax law area, the tax department, for regular mums and dads, and I often get this wrong, but for regular mums and dads, it's on the date you sign the contract when your capital gains tax obligations start and end. For property developers, it's on the date of settlement of everything, because they then treat it more like stock. The tax department says the land is stock or the unit is stock. It's the day you settle to the day you settle. That's where your capital gains tax liability will be for. Okay. And so you're bearing all those things in mind when you're talking to clients about what things are good for them and what aren't. That then leads into the structuring elements of, okay, well, if this is going to be a taxable situation, how do we set you up so that you can minimize the amount of tax you pay? Because that's what everyone wants to do. They want to minimize the tax, preferably pay none, and maximize the swelling of their bank balance.
Yeah, with the obviously we've used a few delayed settlements as well, and I think we the most recent one that we settled, we had to pay the stamp duty interest.
Yes.
So can you explain, if you're getting long settlements, just so people are aware, why are we paying stamp duty interest, and how does that all work out?
Okay, so in a generic sense, the state governments have the obligation to raise their own taxes. They get some of them from the federal government, but most of it they've got to raise themselves. One of the ways they raise their revenue is by taxing you at a state level. So land tax is a state tax. Other than your principal place of residence, everything you own in a company or a trust or outside of your principal place of residence adds up to a point where you'll get a land tax bill from the Queensland government. Queensland government, having had their whole system computerised for a lot longer, they say, hey, we know what you own as at midnight 30 June. We'll send you a land tax bill. You have to pay it. When you go to Mexico down in New South Wales, their system is slightly different. I think they're coming quicker to the same as Queensland. But in New South Wales, you would have to lodge a piece of paper with them saying, this is what I own. They would then send you your land tax bill that you would then pay. The land tax thresholds in different states are different. If you're a foreigner, there's a penalty there's an additional tax. I call it a penalty because if you're an Australian, it's a penalty that they add to the fee and say, okay, you're a foreign interest. Not only do you get this regular land tax, but you now have to pay an extra 4% or 5% because you're a foreigner. For stamp duty, same situation. You will pay maximum, I think, 5.5% stamp duty at more than $1 million. If so, it's a graduated scale up to that point, and then it's flat rate from there. If you're a foreigner, there's an extra 8% tacked on. All right. So it's nothing to buy for a foreign person to walk in the door and say, I want to buy this $1 million property. And I say, that's going to cost you $100,000 in duty and other bits and pieces just to own it. Whereas for these guys, it would only cost them, say, $20,000 to $30,000. And that's a big impost. And if you're a foreigner and you're needing to get Foreign Investment Review Board approval, they've just doubled the amount of, in last year, they doubled, it used to be $14,000 to something under $1 million. It's now $28,000 for an application. Yeah. All right. And they said that's 0 to 1. 1 to 2 is double that. 2 to 3 is double that. 3 to 4 is double that again. And that's for residential land. You go and buy a $50 million rural property, no problem. You don't get to dabble in all of that. Your fee might only be $1,500 for the FIRB. But nonetheless, there's a fee there. There's a fee over for the state. So stamp duty is just another tax. Back to your question. Stamp duty is just another tax that the government is claiming. In Queensland, you must pay... your liability for the duty arises 30 days after the contract is unconditional for finance, pest and building, or those, or due diligence type things. Things that you largely don't have any control over the outcome of. If it's just, I want to make my contract subject to the sky being blue on the day, or, you know, something else happening, the duties officer say, no, that's something you have full control over. You were meant to pay stamp duty back here, and they will charge you what's called unpaid tax interest. Mm. That's about 12 to 13% interest that they charge you. Sometimes when you're starting out, as a developer, that's not a bad thing. You sit there and say, I've got to pay a $30,000 duty bill, but I don't have the $30,000. Okay, when do I have to pay it? Oh, it's another 2 months away. How much is the interest going to be? It's going to be $5,000. That's okay. Rather than me going into my credit card and paying 20%, I'll pay the 13%.
Yeah.
That's cheaper and economically viable to do. Yeah.
Can we just delve into land tax? Because a lot of the people that will be listening to this, whether they're renting or whether they own their own property, which we call a PPR, primary place of residence, you then go into the property development world and you go, oh, I'm going to do a JV and we're going to buy this block of land for $2 million.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you get this, you go to your PO box and you get this bill for $18,000, which is called land tax.
Yeah.
What is land tax? How does it work?
Yep.
What are the thresholds?
Okay. Easy question. How does it work? The government grabs their money from you and says, thank you. It goes into the consolidated revenue for the state and they spend it wherever they like. So as much as the police will get out there and say to you, we're going to add a 10% tax on cigarettes for the benefit of health of your country. Once it gets into the consolidated revenue, they don't have to spend it on health. They don't have to do any of that. It's just spent on roads,
whatever they want.
So that's how it works.
Makes me feel a lot better about paying it.
Yeah, it does. And if we think this is bad, you want to go into the mining industry where Shannon spent some part of his time, and you see the royalties that the government extracts from these guys. There is never a check that is written with less than 6 zeros on it. Never. I've got one particular client where I've warned these guys where they're heading. Is one particular client I do work for. He has a regular land tax bill of in excess of $1 million. And you sit there and say, wow, that's a lot of money. But yes, he owns a lot of property. And okay, so you sit there and say, gauging it, that's like, you know, it's still painful.
When you look at it, you go, he might be paying $1 million a year in land tax, but with that amount of land, it might be going up by $5 million a year. So he's still $4 million ahead.
He sits there with, 500, 600 blocks of land in static mode at any one time. And so it's okay because he sits there and goes, okay, well, it's like a gold mine. I'll just go and chip a little bit off, sell it, pay the bills. And I've still got 490 of these things and I've still paid all my way for the year. I'm okay.
Yeah.
So the land tax is just because you own something at midnight, 30 June, then you get a land tax bill. It's not pro rata. It's not like rates that you pro rata it between each other. And so that's why in residential contracts, there's a thing that says, if you've got a land tax bill, that's all on you. Me, the buyer, I don't have to pay. When we do development sales, we reverse that around a bit and say, no, we actually have a stack of this stuff and we want you to pay your share.
Yeah.
A lot of the buyers sit there and the advisors to the buyers say, you're not meant to be paying all this. But then you get down to the tin tax, and I say to them, look, What we're talking about is your share for half a year or three quarters of a year or a quarter of a year of $500. You might only be up for $100. That's the liability that we're really talking about. Once you explain it like that, the buyer goes, that's okay. Leave the clause there. I'm happy to do that.
Yeah.
And it's more about explaining it. New South Wales land tax is 31 December. So as you go from state to state, you've got to be aware that you're when in Rome, do what the Romans do, as it were. You know, find out what the law is there. Make sure that you're compliant with that one, because if you're thinking it's the other one, then, you know, you might get caught. It's not uncommon that, and for lawyers, it's particularly relevant around when you have a settlement that's due on the 30th of June, and someone says, oh, I can't settle today. Can I settle next week? And ordinarily you sit there and say, sure, no worries. We'll give you the extension. Well, all of a sudden you've now owned that land over 30 June, that midnight 30 June date. And now you're going to cop a land tax bill. Well, that's okay. How much is that? $15,000. That's not okay. And how do I get that back from the other guy? Well, we can't, because when we wrote that contract, we didn't think this would happen. We always thought it was going to happen within that 12 months.
So how does it work if you have a land tax bill?
You're going to pay it.
Right. You got to pay it.
Yep.
But say that's for the year, right?
Yes, correct.
So say if you move into that property,
yep,
3 months in, you paid the 10 grand.
Yep.
You now move into the property,
yep,
and it's your primary place of residence. Yep. What happens to the balance?
They keep it. It's like gambling. They keep it. So because it's all based on what happened at midnight, 30 June.
Yeah.
On that day, was it your principal place of residence? No, it wasn't. It might become your principal place of residence on the 1st of July, but you've got the bill because on the 30th of June, you hadn't moved in. And it's for the whole of that year. And so you could move in a week later or 3 months later, like you said there. I moved in 3 months later. They sit there and say, look, you could ask us. We might give you an ex gratia payment. We're here. Here's some money. If I was a charity, I would go for the ex gratia payment. But for everyone else, you're not likely to get it. They'll just sit there and say, no. Come 30 June next year, you're not going to get a land tax bill because now it's still your PPR. Okay. But today, bad luck.
Interesting.
Yep.
One of the biggest mistakes I made earlier, and we've spoken about a couple of times, was around the GST margin scheme. And a lot of new developers kind of don't even factor it in. It's not in the feasibilities.
I was going to say that when Eric asked, apart from the DD, I was going to go on to the GST. They don't factor in the GST. They don't think about it.
Yeah. So can you explain a little bit around the margin scheme and how the government actually will take that money?
Okay.
It's not like selling a T-shirt where you'll pay your GST when you need to pay it. It's like, you know, you have to pay that before it even gets distributed to us. And how is the what is the margin scheme and how much, you know, is it 10%? How does it work out?
Okay. So GST is GST and capital gains, which is goods and services tax, and CGT, capital gains tax, they're federal taxes. They apply Australia-wide. So you're at that situation where if you're in the business of doing something that you produce a service or a good, me doing legal work, I'm producing a service. When I sell that service to you, if my revenue from that service is likely to exceed $75,000 in a year, I must be registered for GST and have an ABN. And then I've got to give you a tax invoice, which has got to quote my ABN and have a couple of other things with it. Under that $75,000, it's optional whether I want to. If I know I'm starting out business and I want to get on that bandwagon, I might voluntarily go in for GST. And you get the option at that stage to have monthly reporting, quarterly reporting, 6 monthly or yearly. And most startups, you get them into the GST and on an annual basis. If you register and you, in my view, stupidly say, I'm going to go on the accruals basis, then every time you acquire something and sign a contract for it on an accrual basis, that is on your books from a tax perspective, that's now on your books. On a cash basis, it doesn't come onto your books until I actually pay for it.
Mm.
Okay. And so for me in my business, I'm on a cash basis. So I, for everything I do, I might send you a bill and you might be one of those people who doesn't like paying lawyers' bills and you might take 6 months to pay it. I'm not going to be paying GST on that liability until I actually get the money back in, because I'm on the cash basis. I'm on the accruals basis. Then the minute I sent the bill, I've got a liability. And when I do my BAS statement, my business activity statement, the ATO is looking out for a check from me for an X dollars. When you're buying and selling residential houses that are secondhand, okay, so that that's the qualifying factor here. It's theoretically you're buying from another mum and dad who are also selling an old house, or for you guys when you go out and you buy an old place that you know you're going to knock down. So that person selling to you isn't registered for GST. This isn't a business for them. And so when they sell it to you, it's GST free. All right, when I buy it. That enables me as the developer to have choices about how, when I sell, how am I going to deal with it? I can add full GST, which is 10%, or I can apply what's called the margin scheme. And that is, I only pay GST on the margin between what I paid for it and what it cost me to develop to sell. And so typically the government has worked out that 7% is a fair range based on what they've heard. And so what they demand of us for acting for developer sellers is we must collect 7% and pay it to the ATO for every sale. And they're clever about it too. They realise that, given you're from the Americas, Australians, we came here from Great Britain.
You were convicts, right?
Convicts, that's sure. Right.
I think that was the story.
That's it. And I was just going to say that.
Don't want to miss that.
You had to steal. You had to be a thief to get over here. Nowadays, it's getting back that way, you know. But and so the Australian government worked out that we're dealing with this rabble that are a bunch of thieves. And so we don't trust the seller to actually give us the money. So what we're going to do is we're going to obligate the buyer in this transaction to collect that 7% and pay it, because they're prime targets. They're worried about what they're going to do. They're the mum and dads that are buying, so they're worried about it.
So what you're saying is, if Shannon and Carson bought a block of land and it was non-GST, right?
Yep.
Off the purchasers, they're mom and dads.
Yep.
They bought it in a company.
Yep.
They've applied for the margin scheme.
Yep.
They paid $1 million for the land. They've subdivided it
yep.
into three blocks, and now they're selling each block for $1 million. That yep. means there's a $2 million gain
yep.
divided by
three
blocks, right? Which is going to be about $675,000, something like that.
Correct.
They want the 7% of the $675,000 when they sell it. They got every minute.
No, okay. The 7% of the $2 million.
Of the full,
if
they sold the $1 million together.
So if I sell one block, 7% of that $1 million. Because you're thinking about what's the gain, the margin.
Yeah.
You're paying 7% on the sale price.
Yeah.
So if I buy it for $1 million, cut it into three, sell each one for $1 million.
Yeah.
The 7% of the sale price.
Yeah.
Goes to the government.
Yeah.
And that roughly equates to that. 670 yeah. the amount of GST you would have paid on that gain.
Yeah.
All right. So that's what they do. So what's that? $70,000 each lot goes off to the ATO.
Question I have is, if you buy the block of land for $1 million,
yep.
You develop it.
Yep.
And you build on it.
Yep.
You now have an asset of $5 million, not yep. $3 million anymore.
Yep.
But you keep it, you don't sell it.
Yep.
How long do you have to keep it for before you don't have to pay the GST?
5 years. Okay. As a developer of stock, you can develop the stock and hold it for 5 years. After the 5 years, no GST payable. Okay. If you sell it within those 5 years,
yeah.
As opposed to selling it straight up, if you say sell it 3 years in,
yeah.
The ATO will give you through your account that you do a pro-ratering down for that.
There'll be an adjustment, but yeah. I want everyone to hear that, right? Because I've been keeping a lot of the stock that we've built
yeah.
and because of that reason,
yeah.
right? Like if you can fund it and if you could get the rent to pay for it, like if you look at the amount of GST that you pay
yeah.
over time and you work out what that return is on the money that's sitting there,
yeah.
It's not bad.
Not bad. It's so not bad. I can't see one on the image behind you, but if anyone thinks about a Meriton apartment, Meriton Apartments, the guy behind that is renowned for building the apartments, selling half, holding on to half. He then rents them out for 5 years. At the end of the 5 years, he then goes and refurbishes them and sells them. And he claims the refurbishment is a deduction for the sale of the property.
And he keeps them as serviced apartments at the same time. So he's collecting income. Holiday rental income, not just permanent income. Correct. Yeah, yeah, that model is unbelievable. Mr. Harry Triggerboff.
Yeah.
Hopefully at some point we could get him on the podcast. We haven't reached out to him yet, but I think he'd be...
If you do, but that's the pinnacle of what you're saying, how it works. And if you're doing it right, you're doing it like Harry does.
I know Carson probably has another scroll there, but I'm just conscious of time.
Okay.
Can we delve into, for this last section, a little bit in regards to
structuring? Okay.
Right. So when people have partnerships versus joint ventures, just very, not too in depth, but let's pretend like we're talking to people that have not done this before. Should I buy it in my personal name? I got my business partner. I'm just going to buy it in Carson and Shannon's name, or should I create a trust? What's a trust?
Okay.
These types of things.
Okay. Ordinarily, I'd be using either a whiteboard or yes. my piece of paper for hieroglyphics at this point, because I find that the hieroglyphics stick.
Yeah.
The words don't.
Yeah. Just very, very high level.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very high level.
So all of those decisions are generally based on either, I'm adverse to risk, and I'm trying to limit the amount of risk I suffer. And the other part of it is I don't want to pay too much tax. How can I lower it? As an individual, you know that there's a graduated scale on income, 20,000 under, there's bugger all income tax. I don't know the numbers any longer, but it gets up to 47. Yep. And then you get your Medicare levy on top of it. So it just tips you over the 50% mark. So that we all know that we're working half of our life for our government. And, so we only get to spend half of it for ourselves, and then they tax the shit out of us as the back end as well. So the idea is to give you as little as possible to retain for yourself for as long as possible.
And that's why they still sell spam at the grocery stores.
That's it. That's it. There's a cutoff. Start with that. So you have that graduated scale. By the time you get up to about $90,000 or $108,000 or something like that, I think it is, you're then paying top dollar for every dollar you earn. Mm. You then look over and say, I hear about these companies. What's the tax limit on those? And it might be, I think it's 27% or 25% at the moment currently. It was 30 for a long time. It's now dropped.
Sorry. So in the short answer for your personal name, if you buy it in your personal name and the project makes or the property makes $500,000.
Yes.
That lands in your personal name and you're going to lose half of that straight away.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. There is another thing about if you're doing an investment purchase, just briefly on that topic. If I buy an investment property and I've kept it for more than 2 years, then more than 12 months, sorry, 2 years. Might have that wrong. Check with your accountant on this one. But if I've held it for more than 2 years and I then sell it, the first thing they say is, okay, well, you've held it for more than 2 years. We will half the amount of gain that you just made. So on that $500,000 situation, we would take off $250,000 straight up and say, okay, well, now you've still made $250,000. Now I bought that in hubby and wife name. That then separates out to hubby and wife. Okay, so I've each made $125,000. They add that in this tax year to your assessable income. Mm-hmm. So if my assessable income is I'm a doctor, I'm earning $3 million a year, there's another $125,000 at my top marginal rate. Not good. If I'm a stay-at-home mum earning no income, that $125,000 gets very beneficial tax treatment. Zero for the first 20, a little bit more for the next. If you then sit there and say, I hear about the companies, they pay this flat rate. That's a flat rate from every cent, from the first cent all the way through, as opposed to an individual where you are a little staggering up. The cutover point, roughly, and again, diagrammatically, it's about $110,000, $115,000, something like that. So once you are expecting that you will regularly generate more than $100,000 a year in income, you're better to be a company, because then you're at 30 cents in the dollar tax and you're saving all of that other bit above. And you use that to fill the gap in up the front. But then, how does a company deal with its income? What does it do with it? It can only get rid of it in two ways. One is it has to have a shareholder dividend. So as a shareholder, you've just got a dividend. I can frank that dividend. That is, I can pay the tax on it, as I've done. I've paid my 30 cents. I give you a frank dividend. You keep the dividend. It doesn't add to your taxable income. Or I can give it to you unfranked, in which case it's just full on income and you've got to add that into your tax. Or I can give you a salary. Okay, I'm a single director company and I want to pay myself a $100,000 salary. That comes out. I still got to pay tax on that $100,000. And then, so all I'm doing is adding more of that high level tax on it. So you're trying to get it out as a dividend. And you say, then you sit there and go, well, that's not good. I'm still earning too much money. What do I got to do? We go into this trust structure then. You say, okay, well, I hear about family trusts. What are they all about? Okay, well, that's one where we'll create a trustee individual or company. Normally, initially, you might be, you know, Shannon as trustee for the Shannon Family Trust. And he will have in that trust as beneficiaries himself, his wife, his kids. And any, and inside the family, generic family trusts, there is a what I call also rans. Like in horse races, there was winners number two, and these guys also ran. So there's your brothers, sisters, uncles, aunties, nieces, nephews, mother, parents, godparents, grandparents, etc. All of that. If you drop a pebble in a pond and radiates out through all your family members, all of those are in your family trust, not by name, but just by definition. And if you have a friend, your friendly family member who is a pensioner, they might be able to earn $10,000 a year and not pay tax. I will make them an allocation out of the trust of $10,000. I then go and ask them, would they like to make a gift back to me of any part of that money? And they will happily gift me back $8,000 because there's no tax on it. So all gifts, no tax, no problem. Not like in the UK. I'm dealing with people at the moment where if I give a gift of more than £3,000 in the UK, gift tax is applicable.
Wow.
Hey, go for that. Yeah. And over there, they have death duties that you pay death duties on. And if I know I'm dying and I give you money, if I die within 7 years, you've still got to pay the inheritance tax on the difference.
Yeah.
Where we don't have that in Australia. This is fantastic. And so it's why, you know, the good part about Australia is no gift tax, no inheritance tax. Every time they try to introduce some of those sorts of things, the masses gather up and say that's crap, and the government backs down on them. They've done that a couple of times.
Can we loop back to liability of the trust?
Yeah, as opposed to income splitting. So I'll just finish off on the family members is all about income splitting, income distribution, and that side of it, and that's minimizing tax. That's the majority of why tax trusts are in play. Back to the, I have a risk issue. So I'll use myself as an example. As a lawyer, there's a fair chance that whether I like it or not, I'll make a mistake. I'm a human. I'm fallible. I will make that mistake. And it's going to cost you money as a result, and you're going to want to sue me. And so I have insurance that I have to have to maintain my practicing certificate. I have to have insurance, and that's set at a certain limit. Fantastic. After that limit, I'm on my own. I can have top-up insurance, but after that limit, I'm on my own. And so at a point in time, a mistake was made and a claim was made on a development site for $50 million against me. And it would have wiped out my regular insurance, even if I had top up insurance, which the firm I worked for did. It wiped that out. And there was still a margin of up above that. So when you go into battle, you're sitting there thinking, well, what about my house? If that judgment is against me, they can come after my house. And so having some of the assets in trusts as opposed to in my own personal name will mean that I won't lose those if I go bankrupt. So if that person had have said, okay, Rod, you know, I still want the other $45 million from you. How about a dollar down, a dollar a week? Will that help? That's not nearly quick enough. Okay, well, I'm going to bankrupt you. Okay, well, I bankrupt. What happens to me? As a lawyer, I won't be able to have a trust account any longer. So I'll have to go and work for someone for a couple of years until I've got through my bankruptcy. Then I can come back out and do the same thing again if I wanted to. So the asset protection is by keeping assets that you want to keep off farm, as they say, either in your wife's name or in a trust that I don't actually control, so that if I go bankrupt, I'm not the trustee in bankruptcy, won't stand in at the head of the trust and say, well, thanks, Rod, you were the trustee of the trust. I'm now your trustee. I'm now directing that $1 million income you got this year was going out to all of your creditors. It's not going out to your family. You can starve this year because of what you did. Bad luck. And away you go.
How about if there's a corporate trust? I mean, we're going to detail here, but if there's a corporate trustee over that trust,
yep,
but you're the director of that corporate trustee, does it stop at the corporate trustee?
No, it doesn't. So the best way to think about the trustee and the trust is like the hat on your head and your body. The hat on your head is the trustee. It can come off and I can put a new trustee on, mm-hmm, with monotonous regularity. But the trust itself is the you, that still owns the asset. And so even if I change the trustee, I can still get to the trust, all right? Because invariably when you go and do borrowings for banks, yep, they'll sit there and say, I want a guarantee from the trustee, yeah, and the directors of trust and the trust.
But if the trust is not owned individually, it's correct, owned by a company,
yep,
like you own units in a trust, and we won't go down that road today.
Yep.
It's still protected?
Yes, your asset can still be protected because, so the best way to do it is, for example, you set up a trust. There's a person inside the trust document called an appointor, yep, or a guardian.
Yeah.
And the idea behind the appointor or guardian is they have an overriding control mechanism on the trustee. So yep, if whoever's in control of the trust goes rogue,
yep,
this person can say, I'm taking that trustee out. I'm putting a new trustee on. Yep. Now, if that guardian or appointor is you and you make a mistake and you go bankrupt, then all of a sudden all of that trust and all of that asset is now available for the trustee in bankruptcy to take and distribute amongst your creditors, which is not what you want. Mm. So you don't want to be an appointor in your own trust. You want people of trust that are in there. So that something goes wrong, I'm bailing out at the top end. I'm putting a new trustee in. Fantastic. But it's not me. And that should keep all of that corpus of asset safe.
Cool. I love that because this is a very important part and this is where a lot of people get wrong. And I know, you know, property courses that I've been to in the past is, you know, asset protection. And let me tell you, I've got trust coming up my yin yang. Yesterday, I literally spent 3.5 hours going through, you know, invoices because my accountants are fairly friendly and I don't pay them like on the day. And then I just bundle them up and then just go bang. Yeah. And it's just like ASIC fees for this one, BAS fees for that one, this trust, that trust, this unit trust, that like corporate trustee, and it all costs money. And that's what people don't understand. So you gotta look at it realistically and go, okay, what risk are you at, right? What type of deals, what are you doing, and what risk exposure do you have, right, versus the asset protection that you're going to need? Because you can go down the road of silly.
Yeah,
right.
I had those discussions with people,
like, and 20 different structures and going, yep, all, you know, and same thing with owning businesses in different things. So you got to take all that with a grain of salt.
Yeah, you look at what works best for you in the circumstances that you have. And as a startup, you sit there and say, listen, you only need to do this at a base level.
Yeah.
If you don't want to have ASIC fees every year to keep your company going, be your own trustee for the time being. But as you develop up and you start doing other things, we will swap the trustee, yep, out. We'll put a corporate trustee in that you won't be a part of, so that you are now safeguarding those assets as you're moving forward.
Did you have another question?
No, that's great. No, thanks for coming on, Rod. I didn't realize how important the solicitor was when I first started in property development. I thought, we'll talk to him at the front and we'll talk to him at the end. But, contracts, doing up body corporate setups, reviewing the lending documents up front, yep, you know, reviewing all of our, creating a lot of our structures. Yep. There's so much that Rod does, even to the, you know, the plant, the tiling at the back end of the projects. And yeah, even if we've had issues, you know, Rod would be the first one I pick up the phone to when we've, you know, a driveway's washed away. Like, what the heck do I do here, Rod? And, you know, there's so many things you don't realize. So you need to find yourself your Rod in whatever area that you're in. Please don't ring Rod. He's the house. Yeah, look, no, I appreciate everything you've done, mate. So thanks for coming on.
You just reminded me of that one where even before settlement, the guy was in there with a backhoe and a chainsaw chopping down trees without approval, you know, from council. And we had one of the other neighbours who'd already settled one of the blocks ring us up and say, this idiot is moving stuff that he's got no right to. And he was driving up and down a shared driveway in a semi-trailer or a dump truck type semi thing, and was tearing up this roadway that was designed for the odd motor vehicle to drive up and down twice a day or three times a day. This guy's going up and down with 10 cubic meter loads of fill, and he filled 100 cubic meters of fill got imported within a couple of hours. Unbelievable. And he was driving over it. Insane.
Yeah, you see a lot of things over the years, definitely. But again, getting a good lawyer, a good accountant, these are part of your expert consultants. We talk about town planners and engineers and architects, but before you're talking to any of those people, the lawyer and the accountant are the first two people that you should be and will be speaking to.
Yeah.
So definitely do your due diligence on them and make sure that they're well experienced. And yeah, on behalf of Shannon and Carson, they speak very, very highly of you. And thank you so much for making the time to be here. Now, I asked Rod at the beginning of the podcast, what is the best way to get in contact with you if people have questions or they want to sit down with you? And, I mean, Carson's probably going, don't do it, don't do it. Rod's got no website. So that's first thing. So for someone that's been in the game for 43 years, all of his work comes through referrals. Yeah. And now that I know Rod and I've been introduced to Rod, guess what? Right? I'm going to be referred by him, by Carson and Shannon, reluctantly. But if you, he was, happy enough to give us, his email. So if you do want to get in contact with Rod, it's rod@jlawyers.com.au. So Rod, R-O-D at just the letter J, lawyers with an S, .com.au. And their phone number is 07557066688. And yeah, that concludes this podcast. And like we always say, guys, like, share, comment, subscribe. We're getting experts on these panels every week to bring value to you guys. So that way you guys don't make mistakes like Shannon and Carson made going, hey, we didn't allow for the GST. Or like someone else goes, I didn't put that due diligence clause and I lost $20,000 because of that scenario. And I can imagine over 43 years, all the stuff that you would have seen. So share this around, guys, if you see it as value. And please subscribe, comment, and we'll see you on the next one. Thank you.
Hey there, I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.